Welcome to another edition of The Wizard's Edge with marketing genius, Jay Abraham. This is Marty Stacey, advocator for the listeners to The Edge. Jay, you are probably more successful than anyone else in some ways of using endorsements. What made you think of using endorsements, and amplify that for part of this edition of The Wizard's Edge?
Sure, Marty, be happy to. First of all, what got me thinking about endorsements is the same thing that got me pursuing the entire path of profitability that I'm known for, and that is leverage. I look for opportunities or strategies that give far more upside probability or yield to somebody and lower or eliminate altogether the downside risk. And an endorsement gives you the best of both of those worlds. Why? Because you're able to go to an individual, an organization, a publication, a professional who has theoretically invested years and years and years of his or her or its life as an individual, life as an entity, building goodwill, establishing an ongoing rapport, validating the trust that's been invested in it by performing honorably, either as an advisor or a professional or by selling a product or service or sending a magazine or newsletter. Point is, hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions, tens, hundreds of millions could have been spent over the years by this entity to establish and validate the trust that they hold in the eyes and the hearts of their customers. And you are able, meaning you, the listener, irrespective of what kind of product or service you have, to go to a company or an individual, advisor, or organization, and by getting them to agree to lend their name, the name of their company or their own name, and a signature on a letter, or by letting you have space in their operation, in their retail facilities, or by allowing you to attend and participate and or display at their trade shows or their business meetings, or by allowing you to share their booth space, or by allowing you to accompany or have your salesperson accompany theirs in the field, or by allowing you to include your sales materials with their products or their letters, you get this instant credibility, A. You get the benefit of enormous amounts of real and intangible expenditure the endorser has spent. You get levels of credibility and trust that you normally would have to work very hard to earn in the outside market. I'll give you an example.
Okay.
If you're listening to this tape, you're probably into the program quite a ways, right?
Right, right.
If you stayed with the program, you probably respect and trust my views, my ideas, my strategies, my methodology or techniques or technology, whatever you want to call it, right?
Okay.
And if I told you about someone and I told you about something and I encouraged you to check it or them out or even urged you to try out their product or service on a riskless basis, and gave you the case from my vantage point of why I thought it had such merit, the odds are high you would probably follow through and do it, don't you think?
Yeah, they are much greater than just from a cold, flat-out approach. I mean, they're astronomically higher.
Many times so. So you realize that I spent 24 months to build this tape set to the point that I could give an endorsement to you. I spent thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars promoting it, producing the tapes to be able to say you should buy Marty's product in this hypothetical example. You, the endorsee, get the benefit of all that cumulative effort for just persuading me to tag you or to write a letter or something like that. And that's to be the leverage, the upside leverage, the massively increased probability of success, the multiple times improved result, and the highly lessened chances of loss or failure are what endorsement produces for you.
How do you generate a list of potential endorsees, so to speak?
Endorsers.
Yes.
Well, okay. It could be endorsers and endorsees. Endorsee is the flip side.
Yeah.
That's the equivalent of host beneficiary, and that's on the receiving end. An endorser is the company or the person or the individual who is lending the full force of their credibility and reputation to you and your name.
Okay.
So what you do is the following. Number one, you ask yourself this. Who already has a strong, highly bonded relationship with the individuals or the entities that you most want to reach and who most represent the prospective customer or client audience you want to be accessing? Who's already dealing with those people? For example, let's say you're a...
How about a real estate agent?
Great, you're a real estate agent. Okay, who's dealing with people in a position to know when they are either inclined to move up or out, to buy or sell? Well, let's see. I guess you could say anyone who rents housing, an apartment, or an individual person who rents single-family rental properties, A, right?
Right, right.
Somebody who knows when marriages occur, B, right?
Okay, sure.
Somebody who knows when people are about to move into a new area, C.
Mm-hmm.
This is a little macabre or morbid, but undertakers, morticians,
doctors,
funeral homes, people like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, who else would be in a good position? Let's just think. I would say certain kinds of craftsmen who are called in to remediate or to remodel or to at least beautify a property in anticipation of listing it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning two transactions, sell and move. Who else, Marty?
Well, I don't know that these are going to be financially beneficial. Clergymen would know.
Yes.
Club associates would know.
Yes. Those are a little bit tangential, but you're not wrong. Point is, it doesn't matter. I don't want to get too elaborate. The point is, in any scenario, first thing you do is isolate and identify who is my target audience. Next thing is, what else would they be doing before they would come to me? Next thing is, what would they be doing at the same time? Who would they be doing it with? Who has the biggest connections to them during the process of doing those things, generically, and then looking through either a directory or Yellow Pages, depending on whether you're marketing regionally, nationally, or internationally, looking through either a directory or a phone directory of generic companies or individuals in that given category. Let's say you sold specialized shoes for people with foot problems. It would seem like that if you got in touch with every podiatrist, that probably would be pretty smart, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And you could also get in touch with orthopedics. And you could probably get in touch with other shoe companies. And you could probably get in touch with other people who sold other kinds of products to people who had those kind of maladies. Does that make sense?
Makes sense. Now, how do you create the message that you want attached?
It depends on the dynamic of the situation. First thing you do is you identify the generic kinds of businesses or organizations or individuals who already have a strong relationship with the people or the businesses you want to reach. Then you find out who the specific entities or organizations are within that category. For example, you figure that funeral directors know people who are going to move. Well, then you get a list of every funeral director in either the geography you're operating in or the geography you want to operate in. Does that make sense?
Okay,
what do you do next? You go to the list of all the individuals, and you either call them or you visit them or you write them, whichever is most practical. You know, from a pure standpoint, first thing you want to do is visit them if you could. Second thing you want to do is talk to them if you can. Last thing you want to do is just write them. But sometimes you have to do all three or at least permutations of them.
Mm-hmm.
So you communicate to that individual or entity that has the capacity to endorse your products or services, and you make a suggestion to him or her or it that there is a basis for a mutually beneficial relationship where a very substantial amount of value can be added to the lives or the businesses or the prosperity or the bottom lines or the whatever, the well-being or the security or the prosperity or whatever, the productivity, whatever it is that your product or service does as far as the result it produces, that can occur in exchange for them basically getting to know a lot more about your product or service. And you have a concept in mind that may or may not be exactly workable, but you would like to present it to them. And then after you present it, you'd like to hear their comments and their feedbacks and their response. That's not terribly threatening, is it?
No, that's fairly low-key.
Innocuous. So you go then and you arrange, hopefully, a direct meeting or, secondly, a telephone scheduled meeting or do it by a letter if you had to. And the goal is to get the potential endorser to recognize that he, she, or it has sunk an enormous amount of effort, time, and investment in the relationship with these people, with their customers, with their members, with their readers, whatever it is, with their subscribers, that they owe it to themselves to get to recoup or reclaim or to regenerate more yield out of that past, current, and the future investment they'll make in those customers, and that there are a number of very, very simple, easy, and strongly viable ways they have of doing that while not taking a dime out of their own pocket, in other words, not taking revenue away that they would normally be realizing from those customers. And finally, that in the process of what you have in mind, they will actually be rendering far greater value to their customers. Their customers will be the ultimate beneficiaries, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the basis upon which you present and you establish the basis for an endorsement. So then you get them to endorse you, and the endorsement takes on potentially a number of different forms. It could be a letter they send to people. It could be a taped interview they do with you. It could be space they allow you to occupy for your product or service in their organization or their organized activities. They may do programs. They may do open houses, whatever it is. It may be that you get to accompany their salespeople or that you have material that is distributed along with their own to their customers. Does that give you an idea?
Yeah, it does. What in essence you're doing there by getting endorsements, is it fair to say shortening or compacting the communication time to
establish
trust?
Well, you're doing three things. That's one of them. You are doing that, and that's a good assessment, very insightful. But you are plugging in. It's like when you plug a modem into a laptop.
Mm-hmm.
You're plugging in to all of their velocity and momentum, all their goodwill, the cumulative total benefit of all the tangible and intangible effort and investment they have made since their very inception in their business or in their relationship with their customer, client, member, associate, subscriber, whatever it is. It's okay. Enormous leverage, Marty.
Okay. Tell me about this the host beneficiary thing. That's the flip side?
Well, it can be. It goes two ways. Host beneficiary is another version of endorsement. Endorsement in its purest sense is me giving you my endorsement, me basically giving you in a letter form, on tape, or if you called somebody and put them on the phone to talk to me endorsing your capacity as a professional, your skill set at interviewing, your dependability at keeping appointments, your follow-through and performance in the editing suite, those kind of things. So all I do is endorse you. And then you would use that endorsement to whomever you want it. Host beneficiary is when you take an endorsement or not. Optimally and preferably, it's when you have an endorsement attached, but it doesn't have to be. It's when you're able to directly access somebody's customer, subscriber, member, or client mailing list, or at least customer list, whatever you want to call it, transactional list. By that, it means you're able to get access to those people who are their customers or clients or subscribers in a way that's very powerful with or without their endorsement. They're letting you access their customers or clients through their means. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. How have you used that? How could someone listening use that?
Well, how have I used it? I've gone to magazines and gotten them to endorse my products or my clients' products and then use their endorsement in their own magazine and outside. I've gone to attorneys and gotten them to endorse ophthalmologists. I've gotten to ophthalmologists who deal with a similar target audience to endorse trust attorneys. I've gone to financial institutions and gotten them to endorse trust attorneys and let trust attorneys also access their customers. I've had clients go to banks and get banks to endorse them in both an endorsement and a host beneficiary to the outside market and also to their own customers. It's infinite, really, Marty.
Your suggestion to people listening to the Wizard's Edge here about using this, I mean, is this something everyone ought to consider?
I would say that everybody listening should do the following instantly. Drop all the other things you're doing for at least a day or two and make yourself lists. Who's already got a strong, tight, bonded relationship with the exact man or woman or organization I want to be selling to? What does that organization look like? Who is my customer? What is it? I mean, is it an individual? If so, is he old, young, wealthy, poor, live in a nice area, live in a bed, live in a house, live in an apartment, own a car, own two cars? Is he educated? Is he not? Tell me everything you know about that person, and as you're doing that, ask yourself a corresponding question. Who else deals with that person on a non-competitive but related issue? What else are they doing, buying? What services are they rendering? What products are they buying? What people are they turning to generically? And then after you get this generic list, then you go specific. You say, okay, within that category, who are all the individuals or organizations? If you found out that podiatrists were the real market for you, you'd get a list of every podiatrist in the area you want to market to, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You'd have their name, you'd have their phone number, you'd have their address, and you'd either send them letters or call them or visit them or call on them to set up a visit. You'd use the multiple media approach, wouldn't you?
Yes.
That's what you do, Marty.
Okay. So basically, for the next couple of days, just concentrate on generating potentialities there.
That's right. That's absolutely right. You do that, and then you start going to step two, which is you start making contacts. Start calling people, visiting people, getting appointments, and then I would say presenting your proposition to them. And your proposition depends on the kind of business you're in. You either could give them an equal share of the profits. I've done that with hundreds of people. You could give them the lion's share or all the profits on the first transaction to get them excited, because if you have a multiple sales product or service where there's a high probability and predictability that you're going to have a repeat purchase, you could give them up to 100% of the profit on the first transaction. You could give them so much a customer, just a flat rate. There's no law what you give them. It's whatever you want them to have.
Okay. All right, let me ask you about something that, in another way, I think characterizes Jay Abraham, and that is being proprietary. And as I've been thinking about you and this concept, it seems to me that not only do individuals need this concept, but businesses of whatever size in these times are needing to deal with it.
Sure. In an era when the world is working constantly, 24 hours a day, to render every human being and every business and every entity into a commodity, we have to basically take it upon ourselves to steadfastly and fiercely and ruthlessly, but ethically, strive to always be seen in a proprietary or distinctive, differentiated way from all the other people, individuals we compete in for whatever we compete in, for love, for money, for commercial success, for special interests. We might have membership in an organization or active interest in a civic group and want ourselves so powerfully, influentially known there that we have to do that through this device.
Amplify about how to get proprietary.
Well, you get proprietary by making yourself stand out more favorably than your competitors, by doing more things, adding more value to your customer or client's or association or organization's life. Your goal is to stop, it's something I said many times in these interviews, is to stop falling in love with your company and your product, but instead fall in love with your customer and to make their interests more valuable in your hierarchy of goals and imperatives. It's to get into your selling proposition more benefits and advantages that appeal to the customer. Same thing for an individual. I mean, you want to make yourself as an employee. You want to make yourself as a prospective boyfriend or fiance or father. You want to make yourself and your authority more distinctive. You want to differentiate you from everybody else out there being a commodity. And as a commodity, you had to compete against everybody. As a commodity, you were expendable. As a commodity, you had to fight and claw for every consideration or advantage, and you were in a non-leveraged, you were in a inverse leverage position where you're under the thumb of anybody who wanted to. You had insecurity, uncertainty, everything was tentative. I didn't like that. I wanted control. I wanted certainty. I wanted to be established and entrenched in whatever I did at such a level that I was invincible. And I thought, how could you be invincible? Well, you had to be invincible by being different, not negatively different, but superior, better, more valuable, more advantageous, more prized, more compelling, more enjoyable, more whatever it was. If it's in a job, you got to bring more value. You got to be more tangibly prized. You got to have more on the ball, more evidence that you're adding value, doing things more productively, more tangibly, more measurably than anybody else. You got to be the one person in the organization who's got the interests of the company at heart. If it's in your relationship, you got to do more, care more, make your spouse make their life better. The whole key is something that I got from Fran Tarkenton. It's simple. Your goal in life, your goal in business, your goal in everything you do, your goal as a friend, your goal as a father, as a mother, as a husband, as a wife, as a lover, is to make the other side's life or situation or business better, richer, happier, safer, more joyous, more productive. And if you keep that in mind, you position and present yourself in a way that is much differently. In the beginning, you do it consciously because it's not a natural thought. But once you start living this philosophy, you do things different. You do more things. You focus on things that have the highest payoff for your customer or your wife or your husband. You are more considerate. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I've been trying to get a grasp of the fundamentals of this. It apparently has to do with differentiation and serving people to a greater extent.
Well, it is. First of all, ask yourself this question. In your life, both as a business owner slash professional, as well as a consumer, there obviously are certain companies, businesses, professionals, restaurants, service organizations, you tend to favor. Amongst the people you favor with your business, there are certain ones that stand out probably so clearly in your mind as people you just love doing business with. Would you agree?
I agree.
Okay,
I agree.
Think about this. Let's just take you as an example.
Okay.
Give me a couple of them. Name them.
Okay, I patronize the bookstore because the people are more caring, more solicitous of getting what I want.
So what do they do? First of all, when you walk in, is it cold and sterile like most bookstores?
No, they know me by name, my face.
And are they gracious and pleasant, and do they engage you?
Right.
And is the environment of the bookstore stimulating?
Yeah, because the books are chosen not necessarily because they're mass-produced, but because they might be of interest to discriminating people.
So, it's, first of all, they're not trying to be all things to all people, and they're not trying to be a medicinalized warehouse. They're trying to identify to discriminating people who want not just books, but very specific kinds of books that people have worked very hard to locate and source for them.
Mm-hmm.
They appreciate you not as a charge card or a check, but they appreciate you as a human being with fascinating interests and opinions and loves and hates and hobbies and the like, right?
Right.
And what else? What else do they do?
Let's see. They will do more for me than any other people would.
Okay. All right. Next. Who else do you buy from?
I'm into natural grains and that kind of thing.
Okay. So where do you go to?
Go to kind of a little unusual place, kind of out of the way, but these people serve me such that my own family would probably not be more solicitous.
Okay, how do they do it?
They're very careful to educate me if I'm not educated.
Okay.
They're very concerned about my bottom line or if I'm getting a fair shake in whatever I happen to be buying.
Okay, well, the point is this. If everybody listening to this tape, if you will do this for me, think about your own life, both in the business arena and also in your private life as a father, mother, husband, a single man or woman, whatever you are. You buy from lots of people, things, products, services, food, eating out, movies. There are probably certain establishments and organizations you tend to patronize or prefer dealing with than others. In other words, we go to three groceries. There's one grocery that I prefer amongst them all, but it doesn't have the fullest selection, so I can't do everything there. But it's got better cuts, better environment, better ambiance, better experience, better quality of food, better everything than the other two, but it's limited in its offering. It doesn't have full sundries and things.
Mm-hmm.
After that, there's another one that's nicer and warmer and cleaner and more varied. Then there's one that's down the street from me, which is sort of dirty and dark and cold and bland and nondescript and commodity-ish. If I am in a hurry, they win through default because they happen to be down the street and have time to go to either of the other two. If I have the time and what I want is available at the first one, that's where I always go. And they are more expensive, but I don't care because I enjoy the experience. I have my cleaning done by a man who comes and picks it up and takes it back. I used to do it by another place that kept losing my clothes. The man that does it charges the same, but the sleeves are stuffed in the shirts and the coats with paper, so it preserves their creases and their folds and their bends. The shirts never, ever, ever are folded to crease them. The man treats them with love, and he always says something neat and brings a chocolate when he delivers it. Does that give you an idea what I'm talking about?
Uh-huh.
I have been married a number of times. I am married to somebody who thinks about me at a level that it's incredible. She makes dinner for me when I'm late. She thinks about my well-being. She's conscientious. She's loving. She's attentive. She's very supportive. She's perceptive. She's funny. She makes me laugh when I'm sad. She gives me contrast when I'm morose. She likes my company. And I reciprocate. And she does for me. She differentiates. I've never, ever, 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 ever met anyone in my context like that. She basically has my undying love and admiration and respect. I think what you're trying to get is somebody's undying love and admiration and respect, don't you?
Interesting.
Is that wrong?
No. I just have been thinking about the word proprietary.
What it means is that you are seen consciously or otherwise in the eyes and the mind and the heart and the soul of the customer you're trying to reach, if you're using proprietary in a business context, you don't have to,
mm-hmm.
as being different, better, superior, above, more whatever, more beneficial, more advantageous, more enjoyable. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
All you got to do is think about that and make sure that your definition of more is in accord with the customers. In other words, what you think is better may not be what they think is better. What you think is valuable may not be what they think is valuable, so you won't have proprietary advantage.
Okay. Speaking of the word thinking.
Yes.
I have been reading a lot, and it all seems to converge on a couple of interviews that we did called lateral thinking. That term keeps popping up.
I thought that was a good interview.
Yes, and I heard Fran Tarkington use the term in the interview that he did with you. Let me ask you the question that's just been driving me out of my mind, and that is, how do you draw a circle around lateral thinking? My favorite joke of all time maybe is little boys ask, how do you spell banana? He says, well, I'm not sure, but I don't know when to stop, B-A-N-A-N-A-N-A. How do you know when to pull the limits in on the lateral thinking?
I don't know when to pull them in?
Yeah.
Well, why don't I give you a context of how to do lateral thinking, and then I'll give you some of the do's and don'ts, okay?
Okay.
Well, a lot of people get all flustered and intimidated and confused and scared of the concept of lateral thinking. Don't do it, Marty. All lateral thinking should be considered is what I'll call CAT scan perspective. You know what a CAT scan is?
Just barely.
Yeah. A CAT scan is either a magnetic, electronic, x-ray process that does a complete overview, and it analyzes from every vantage point a section of your body. A CAT scan of your brain, for example, would look at it orbitally. pivotally, diagonally. We look at it from three or four or five different planes. Does that make sense?
Okay, yeah.
To get a context. And from that, it will see all the dimension, all the complexities, all the intricacies, all the growths that are there. You want to look at your situation from what I call a CAT scan perspective. Most people tend to be literal and linear in thought and action. They think up and down or side to side, and their movements go accordingly. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Are you sure?
Well, see, I'm the kind of guy I could think about something till the cows come home.
Well, but the trick is this. You think about things for two reasons, in my opinion. One is a result that you're trying to accomplish. The other is a growing awareness that is part of the stimulus and the development of the power of your mind. And by that I mean, there's nothing wrong with thinking about things till the cow comes in, except for doing it at the wrong time. I'm reflecting on things forever. That's part of my stimulus. But I have another mode that I go in, which is resolution mode.
Okay.
And when I'm in resolution mode, it means I'm going to think about something to come up with the best reason, the highest yielding, the easiest, simplest, safest, most powerful means I can come up with at that point in time based upon the scope of my knowledge, the scope of my reflection, and the scope of my understanding of all the possibilities that I have been exposed to, channeled together towards the subject matter or issue or problem or challenge that I am dealing with. Does that sound too abstract?
No, I think I can follow that.
So what I'm saying is, I think about things constantly. In fact, you and I had started this conversation, and we stopped it because I asked to go get myself a cup of coffee. And when I was walking to the other room, I was looking at something, and my mind traipsed on thoughts about that. And I was engaged in that for about an hour, or not an hour, for about 10 minutes, or what seemed like an hour. And then you called and interrupted me, and I went back to resolution mode. And I concentrated on thinking about the clearest articulation I could come up with this moment in time on lateral thinking, on endorsement, on host beneficiary, on all the things that we've talked about. Your mind has the capacity, if you won't try to bridle it, to do things. It can think expansively and infinitely on things, and it can also, if you channel it and challenge it to do so, it can go out a certain degree, snare or snag all the relevant information or knowledge it has on all kinds of related subjects, draw it together, process it, give you the best reasoned conclusion at this point in time. And you just have to discipline yourself to know there is a bottom line you've got to come up with. And it may not be the absolute best that you could come up with if you had an extra 10 days or an extra 5 phone calls to gather information or the chance to talk to an extra 25 people. But based on your ability and your resources and available data today, this moment, or whenever you've got to come up with your conclusion, your solution, your idea, your strategy, your action, your resolve, you let your mind do what it can automatically do quite well. Is that too confusing?
No, that's very clear.
You got to come from the understanding that your goal is this. My goal is to start saying I'm going to think CAT scan. So I'm going to look at things logically like everybody else does. Then I'm going to look at them the opposite way. Then I'm going to look at them for what about them is similar. Let me give you some templates or matrices to think about, okay?
Okay.
So the first thing you do when you're thinking CAT scan is you go through logics before you go to what I'll call illogics. And logic is the way everybody else would do it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So whatever you're thinking about or concerned with or facing, the first thing you'd say is, what would everybody else do? And then you'd ask yourself, is that the best way to do it? And you can't really say yes or no until you next say, what are the other options I could utilize or approach to take to deal with this issue or with this situation? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you start thinking uninhibited. You don't say, well, everybody else in the radio business sells advertising by the 10-second, 30-second, 60-second. So which of the three is the best? I wouldn't say that. I'd say, well, is there a better way to do it? And I'd ask what other ways might be doable in terms of what is possible technically, what is possible structurally, what is possible editorially without breaching the integrity of your format, what is possible regulatory-wise based on what you're allowed to do in every hour time-wise. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd say, what can I absolutely not do? And I'd start with that, because if you know that you can't do this, then everything else is fair game. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. That's a monumental proposition.
To your mind, it's not. First thing you want to do is say, okay, here's how I would approach this. Then if you had the time, what I would do before I would try to do it myself is I'd call other people in related and different fields. And I'd say, how would you go about either resolving this, meaning either what's the process or what is the actual result or what is the idea or what is the strategy? And I ask all those questions. And I wouldn't just listen to the answers. I would listen to or ask, how did you get to that answer? Because people might say, well, it's so logical. Well, it's logical to them. It might be illogical to you. Well, it's so logical. What's the logic you're using? And then ask them to explain themselves. Mm-hmm. And if it's profound, say, well, where did you learn that? And they'll either know or they won't. If they don't, then say, well, what do you think your thinking process is based on? By asking these kinds of questions of enough people, you are transferring and expanding your own mindset and infiltrating into it various components of these people you admire. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And soon your mind takes on the best elements of their mind. So you are expanding exponentially. Exponentially. I just came up with a concept we're developing called the X factor. And the X factor is a way of thinking, acting, and being exponential.
Mm-hmm.
It's high velocity moves in your life, transactionally, thinking-wise, relationship-wise, that move you geometrically to many rungs up in the quality, the quantity, the prosperity of your life, your business, your actions, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it does.
A little philosophical, and you might want to drag me down to specifics because my brain's a little bit better now.
We continue with the program on Side 2. All right, go ahead, because you have probably been instrumental in more change than most trainers, I would guess. I don't know how to quantify that, but you've seen a lot of people markedly change after they've left your seminars, true?
I feel like that song, I've seen all people. I've seen a lot of people, Marty, and I've seen a lot of people go through transformation. I've seen a lot of people become much happier, much richer, much bolder, much more adventurous, much more joyous, much more prosperous. Make much higher contributions to their industry, their family, their customers, their society, the world. I've seen a lot of things. So based on the expanse of observed and contributed experiences, what do you want me to tell you?
Well, how do you get this great velocity going?
Well, first thing you do is by believing it is possible. You got to believe it's possible because the world I was talking, it's not religious and it's not metaphysical. It's a realization that is very important, and that is that the world doesn't care. It doesn't care either way. It's not holding you back. It's not limiting you, but it's also not. It's not rooting for you. It's not rooting against you. It's like you got this clean playing field to play any game you want at any level you want, as long as you want, and at whatever level of intensity you want. Does that make sense?
Not exactly.
Well, what I'm saying is a lot of people don't ever get off the dime because they really and truly and genuinely don't think it's possible for them. And they basically, you know, they stumble. They inhibit themselves. They do all kinds of things to keep themselves from achieving anywhere close to their goal. I come at it a real simple way. Number one, if you're going to get up in the morning, if you're going to be in a relationship, married or otherwise, if you're going to father or mother children, if you're going to take a responsible job or be the helmsman or woman of a for-profit or a non-for-profit entity that has purpose in being in its existence, you owe it to yourself and you owe it to that organization or individual and everyone else dependent upon that individual or organization to give and get the absolute most you can, Marty, out of every hour, every day, every week, every decision, every action, every commitment, every filament of emotion, every penny of investment, every piece of capital, every piece of human capital you employ. Does that make sense?
Yes.
If you content yourself with less than your fully deserved result, outcome, or payoff, you're a thief, but you're cheating yourself and other people out of what they and you are entitled to. In other words, how does it feel to know you're a thief, that you might be denying your listeners on your radio show 70% greater experience from every hour they listen to you on the phone because you're not operating at your peak capacity. You're not asking the scope of the questions you could. You're not having the depth of commentary between records or between interviews you could. How does it feel to know that in the process of that you're not earning every dime you should because you're not adding all the value you could to your station, so you're not being paid every dime you deserve because your contribution isn't realized or recognized? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. What is the mechanic, or maybe this is the wrong question, why do we tend to settle for less?
I don't think it's that we settle for less. We only settle for what we've had. It's like Roger Bannister in the 4-Minute Mile.
Mm-hmm.
Up until he set the 4-Minute Mile, I think that no one had ever even come close, right?
Right.
Why do you think the first year after he did it, something like 120 people either hit it or exceeded it? Now, was that a remarkable year where the moon and Mars were convergent for 12 months? No. It was that somebody realized and broke through the barrier. I mean, if tomorrow morning you got a raise of $10,000, I suspect you would be operating at a $10,000 increase level probably from then on.
So you're saying that the problem is actually fundamentally belief.
If you've never experienced greatness, if you've never experienced a level of achievement or prosperity or contribution or personal performance and anywhere close to the level of capacity you are capable of, a few minutes ago I was tired, and you know, we talked about that. I was talking to somebody today who sleeps 3 hours a day, and he's got more energy than I do. And I said, well, how do you do it? And he has mastered an understanding that his body needs only what it needs, that tiredness and fatigue for many people and many times in our lives are nothing more than a cop-out. Did you ever see the movie The Right Stuff?
No, but I'm familiar with it.
It's a chronicle of man's pursuit of space.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts with Charles Yeager, Chuck Yeager. And it shows him breaking the sound barrier. And it talks about how most people didn't want to do it because it scared them. And when he was going through it, his plane was shaking and resonating and vibrating, and it was a scary ordeal. He thought, oh, shoot, I'm going to implode. I'll never see my wife again. I'll be dead meat. And then once he broke through the barrier, it was quiet and glorious. And then from breaking the speed barrier, you know, the sound barrier, whatever it is, then they knew it could be done and they weren't going to die. And it's like very rarely are we going to die. If I ask you to work at a 25% greater capacity, I don't think you're going to die. If I ask you to not be content to just do the work you do at 8 hours, but to do 25% more tomorrow in 8 hours, you're probably not going to die. You're probably not going to have a nervous breakdown.
So you're saying a lot of these limitations are just basically self-imposed.
Well, let me ask you this question. I can't remember. Do you do exercises or work out?
Not formally.
Okay. What do you do? What's your hobby?
I just read and talk to people, Jay.
Okay. Well, let's talk about reading. How many books do you read a month?
Probably 15, 20, I suppose.
Okay. Which one I would say, using my oneness commentary here, is a substantial number of books, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like a book every 2 days, isn't it?
Roughly, yeah.
How many pages do you read or words do you read a minute?
It depends on how I'm reading.
Well, me from what to what?
Probably 400 to 500.
How did you learn how to do that?
I had to for work.
But most people would say, Most people read 150 or 200 words a minute, don't they?
Yeah. 200, yeah.
About 200. Okay, so why is it you can read three times as much with good comprehension?
Because of the desire, I guess.
Because to you it's important enough, but you did it one time sometime in the past, and your brain didn't heat up and explode. Your eyeballs didn't fall out and roll down the stairs. Your heart didn't beat so fast that it collapsed and imploded, did it?
Not that we know of.
But you learned it could be done, and your body could do it. Your mind could do it. The only change was, all of a sudden, you became three times more productive in the same period of time, right?
Yeah.
And three times more productive in a lifetime means you can live the life of three people, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And means you could accomplish what three people would do, but it's probably more than that because the rules and laws of exponentiality come into play, don't they?
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Maybe a little esoteric, but first thing is realizing it can be done. The next thing is doing it yourself. When I do training programs, one of the things I try to do is make people have realizations right there and then, because if and when they do, it's real to them. It's not theoretical and intimidating. If you had to land a plane yourself because the pilot died, I wouldn't think that would be something you'd want to ever do again. But the fact that you did it probably would change your whole context on fear. Probably things that used to intimidate you that seem so horrific were probably inconsequential on a contrast after that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You sure?
Yeah. The reason I paused there is one of my tasks here at interviewing you and one of the questions I've been trying to ponder is what
don't
is
tell the, me the meaning of life.
What is the difference between a cassette interview and experiencing J. Abraham in person? And you've, I think, answered that question for me.
Well, when you reach me in person, there's a different bond and connection. And while I don't set out to be a motivator or inspirer, I am told that because I have something you don't have, not you personally, but the person, I have a higher level of confidence and the utmost of faith and belief in your ability to do much more than you've allowed yourself. And I think that comes forward. And when you're working with me directly, I won't let you off the hook because it's easier to do more than less. If you're going to run a mile in 4 minutes instead of 4.5, one could say, hey, you're more efficient, couldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could say it's harder, but I would say it's easier.
Okay.
Once you understand efficiencies.
Okay.
It depends on how you look at it, don't you think?
Yeah.
So to recharacterize and redenominating your definition base.
Yeah. One of my quests in these interviews, and I guess it's been a personal goal, is to understand how do you transform people, because there's not a lot of people capable of doing that.
Well, I mean, it's three incantations, and I kick my heels.
Red slippers, too, I see.
And then I go, you are getting fatigued. I have this incredibly beautiful gold-plated, not real gold, pocket watch on a fob, and it goes tick, tick, tick. You are getting more ambitious.
What?
You are getting more focused. No, not really. I think I show people. What I do is real simple. I've explained in one of these interviews exactly how to do it for yourself so I can save them 5, 15, 25. I got a new program that's going to ultimately be about $50,000 if I ever get it perfected. But I can save people the trouble.
Okay, we're listening.
All you have to do is, are you ready? All you have to do is question and interview a lot of other people who've already done what you don't have the wherewithal to do and ask them how they did it, what their mindset was, how they looked at it, why they believed it could be done, what gave them the capacity to do it, what devices they used, and how they felt before, during, and after. If you do that to 25 or 30 people, you're going to get such great answers that you're going to say, this isn't so hard. It's pretty easy when you think about it the way they have. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You sure?
Yeah, it does.
I come from it very simple. I am a pragmatist. I think most of us make our lives 100 times more complicated, 1,000 times more convoluted than it has to be. And I think that we accept at best half and at worst a negligible fraction of the happiness, the achievement, the fulfillment, the contribution, the wealth, the excitement, the everything we could get out of our lives or our business. And I find that unacceptable.
When you do your seminars, it seems like you require people to write a ton of stuff down before they come. True?
Yep.
People listening to this tape typically are not going to do that. True? Do you want to predict on that?
Whether people are going to do that?
Yeah. Let me just ask you generally. Do you think people tend not to write all that they should?
Most people don't engage in what I call deep, concentrated thinking. And deep, concentrated thinking starts with a determination to not be superficial. And not being superficial is achieved by being, well, deep, being substantive, being like seminal in what you do. And that only happens by, first of all, making your thoughts, making your observations, making your awarenesses your prisoners forever. How do you do that? Do you do it by just glibly talking about it and then moving on to something else? I don't think so. Do you do it by recording it? Maybe if you have a discipline enough to listen to it, but most people don't. When you write it down, two things occur. Number one, you make it a prisoner in an easily accessible manner if you're organized. If you're not organized, you throw it in a box, you can keep looking at it in the future. Number two, there is a process that has to go, the thought has to go through your brain and be channeled through other mechanisms than just the creative one that conceived it. Like it's conceived, I read an article, I don't remember exactly what this is, so my recollection and my explanation may be off by a massive amount, but as I recall, it's envisioned or visualized or given birth to in a certain part of the brain, but when you write it down, that thought has to be transported in images and pictures, almost like the Star Trek transporter where it's broken apart and reassembled. And as that's happening, in my hallucinatory interpretation, it may not be real work, it has to be processed through so many cells and nerve endings that it has more clarified, residual, retained awareness in your brain. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so I think if you write things down, you retain it. You understand it. It's dimensionalized many times better than if you just conceive of it and think you're going to remember it forever. I don't remember things. I come up with an idea in the middle of the night and think, well, I can't wait till the morning when I write it down. I don't remember it. You ever do that?
Yeah.
I've dictated things, and the next day I never listened to the dictated tape. You ever do that?
Mm-hmm.
So I try to write things down. I keep pads everywhere. Everywhere, Marty.
Okay.
You should, too. Next question. Let me try. Did you ever watch the old Johnny Carson show?
Yeah, yeah. He's
Karnak.
In Nebraska.
Remember Karnak?
Yeah.
The answer, Marty, is yes. I'm having fun now.
There's an article in the February 26th edition of Newsweek that talked about current brain research. They have discovered that when a person has obsessive compulsive disorder, they have found out that if they can get the typically child to rehearse, the person is stuck in a behavior.
Yep.
They can actually see that on the brain scan. When they see that he starts to get stuck, they have him stop that thought and practice something else.
And
what happens is that they watch the brain stop that pattern and go on to something else.
That's fascinating.
And it seems to me what we've been talking about today is that what Jay Abraham is advocating is that, let's take a marketing problem, is actually a fixation, a mini obsessive compulsive problem in the brain. Is this a fair paradigm?
I'll accept it. I mean, see, the nice thing you got to realize, Marty, it's whatever you want it to be. If that works for you, it's a great paradigm.
It seems to me that you're saying that the brain is can be stuck on a problem, and what you are about, by my paradigm at least, is getting people to practice a new behavior.
I don't see problems in the negative context. I see them as wonderful opportunities for coming up with very inventive, innovative, and non-traditional solutions. And if you look at everything in your life, I'm not perfect, Marty. I have my down days. I don't want you to think that I'm a superhuman man, because I am human. I get hurt. I get sad. I have to regenerate my enthusiasm occasionally, too. So don't think of me as being holier than thou. That notwithstanding, most of my life and most of the time in my life, I have cultivated a philosophy that takes adversity and looks at it in the light of where is the opportunity here, that takes problems and looks at them and says, there's an incredible opportunity if you can figure it out here, that takes disappointments and says, I have experienced this to productively be able to do what? And where is the opportunity here for me? I won't do that again. Instead, what will I do? What has it taught me to do productively, more profitably, more effectively, more successfully? It is an attitude, if that makes sense.
But attitudes are hard to get a hold of.
Says who? If you believe that, they are, Marty. I mean, I tend to live in a world that says you can change your attitude, you know, in the click of a finger or the snap of a whatever you snap, or a beat of a heart.
You're going to nail me on this, but I'm...
You must be a card-holding member of Status Quo Anonymous. I mean, Marty, look, is the world static? No. You ever heard the phrase, grow or die?
I've heard it.
Okay, well it doesn't mean that you keep expanding your girth. It means your body regenerates cells continuously. Either businesses grow or they regress. They do not stay static. In life, as human beings, our bodies don't stay static. Supposedly, every cell gets replaced, I don't remember how many times, either a day or a week or a year. You might know that. You've read so many books. How many times?
Different parts of the body, different times.
Okay, but it's
generally,
true, isn't it?
Yeah, 7 years.
It constantly regenerates. If we never regenerated any cells, what would happen? We would die because we weren't regrowing. If we never regenerated new customers, what would happen? We would die because we would have attrition, or we would stagnate. Stagnation is 1 degree before
rigor mortis.
Yeah, it's like it's a couple degrees before that. You stagnate, then you start slowly dying, don't you? Piece by piece. That's the lowliest, the loathsomest, the most unnecessary thing to do. You avoid that by growing, and you grow two different ways. You grow by stretching yourself, doing more, learning more, trying more in business, and you grow by being more, caring more, discovering more, giving more, learning more, loving more in life. It's just a sort of, if you're asking, trying to subtly learn J. Abraham's mindset, I'm trying to open my cranial cavity up and pour it out
well,
to you on a platter.
I recognize that. I appreciate that.
You're very welcome, Marty. My great pleasure.
It seems to me that most people do not change.
I would say that most people do not know how to change, and they are fearful of... Can you remember the first time you ever went on a long trip?
Kind of.
The thought may have seemed exciting, but I also suspect it was somewhat intimidating. If you've never flown on an airplane, even though it might have been exciting, it probably was scary. If you've never been to a big city before, even though the thought was exciting, it was probably intimidating. If you've never stayed in a hotel before and you were on a limited budget, even though it was an exciting thought, it was expensive, it was awkward, you didn't know whether to tip. Every time you wanted to order room service, it was expensive. What, is that wrong or right?
Yeah, you're right.
So it was exciting in abstraction, but it was intimidating transactionally if you broke out the parts.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, do you think maybe that various growth aspects of life or business are the same way? There's nobody who can say, no, I don't want to make more money. No, I don't want to be more successful. No, I don't want to have more customers.
Yeah.
But the abstract thought's exciting. But the process is really awkward. Let me give you another example. Did you ever resolve to work out? Did you ever resolve to build those muscles and be the mighty Marty Stacey, the magnificent, monumental, muscular Marty Stacey? Did you ever resolve to do that?
Oh, yeah.
And go into the gym and start lifting weights, and even though the thought was exciting and the outcome was exciting, the process was painful and awkward and intimidating and a little embarrassing when everyone else is lifting 500 pounds with one finger and you're lifting 5 pounds and falling sideways because it's so intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
And you maybe stopped doing it because it was more painful and awkward and scary and embarrassing than you had imagined, right?
Right.
But still, the concept of the outcome, the concept of what you want to be muscular, mighty, monumental Marty Stacey is still appealing, even though you say, I'm never going to work out again. So I think the trick is to break down your demons into little baby steps and then take them. If the idea of working out every day is intimidating, instead of giving up, say, okay, the first thing I'm going to do is get into the habit of going to the gym every day. And if I can't lift the weights, the first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to sit in the sauna. I can do that. That's fun. Then after 5 days of doing that, you got a precedent started. I'm going to sit in the sauna for only 15 minutes instead of 25 when I go to the gym. And I'm not going to lift the weight. I'm going to lift just the bar of the weights on. Well, lift it 10 times. Let's do that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And if you take the same exercise and apply it to business, is it any different, really? I think not.
Okay. This see, as I have been reading the area of change, and you can put personal change or business change, most people are incredibly resistant to change, practically speaking.
They are. There's a lot of schools, and I don't purport to be expert in all. There's a school of change that is predicated on neurolinguistics and neurolinguistic conditioning that says your goal is to put yourself in a position where you have more incentive than disincentive to do something, where you move the leverage in your favor instead of against you. If the leverage is negative, you think, this is expensive, this takes a lot of time, I don't know how to do it, I'm doing it wrong, I'm screwing up, it's not working, I'm wasting money, I look like a fool, I'm going to lose money and be no better off, my employees are going to think I'm a fool, my banker's going to call my loan. Well, that's not great leverage, but if everything you do is a win instead of a lose, because you reorder the process and break it into little baby steps that are all successful steps, then it's exciting. Think about if a baby had to go and walk instantly and leapfrog in great big giant strides from one end of your house to the front yard, and if he couldn't do that, he'd never walk, then he or she would probably never walk, would they?
Right.
But they get up and they take a little step and they fall over. But the little step was really exciting because they made progress.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yeah.
What else do you want to talk about?
Be my guest. We have about 20 minutes left in the tape if you would like to pursue.
I don't know. I mean, it doesn't matter. What do you want to talk about? I mean, I'm open to anything and nothing. It doesn't matter. I mean, I'm having fun now. You want to ask me a question amongst all questions?
I'm not sure I know what you're saying.
You got a predominant question that you just personally want to ask?
We're on the track that I have been trying to fathom because I, just as an interviewer, Jay, I have been fascinated by your success. And I've been fascinated by why people can come to a seminar and go away changed and why typically people can read a book or actually go to, I don't mean to flatter you, but go to a lot of other seminars and typically there's just maybe a two-month high and then things go away. And you have been explaining to me why you have been able to execute the change you have.
Well, I think it comes from something else. I mean, when I do programs, I embrace them. Everything I do embrace with, as I said before, the utmost of confidence that people really will do so much more once they're shown how. In other words, I don't believe that you went into the radio business to achieve half of the success that you could. I mean, I refuse to accept that. I don't believe that a business owner went into the steel foundry business to produce a third of the foundry parts that he could and to sell them to a third of the customers he could or she could. I just don't believe that. I don't believe that somebody makes $200,000 a year because they don't want to make six. I don't believe that. I don't believe that you raise a child that, quote, goes bad because you don't want to raise a good one. I believe that most of the people don't know the right or the better or the best or the highest or the higher outcome or yielding strategies, actions, or approaches they could take. That makes sense?
Yeah, that's not the way I thought things were.
But it's a profound thought to contemplate, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the trick is we think we have to come up with, this is delusionary. I for one, thank goodness, abandoned that long ago in a galaxy far, far away. There is this delusion that believes that we have to come up with it by ourselves. Maybe we can have occasionally listen to a Jay Abraham tape or some other person or a Marty Stacey tape and, we'll get a couple of ideas. I choose differently. I choose that everything I want to know, I go to people who've already been there. People have been there and succeeded. People have been there and gotten cut off at the knees. Get cut off at the knees, at least, unless you're a liar to yourself. You know what happened. And if you just tell me what happened, and I ask you, why do you think that happened, and I ask you, what's the lesson there, and if you're going to do it again, what would you not do, and what would you do? I've learned from that, haven't I?
Mm-hmm.
But I talk to a lot of people, Marty. I mingle in the party of life. And I think most of us don't. Most people don't.
Okay, talk about...
They're wallflowers. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Talk about mingling. What does that mean? How do you do it?
Mingling means really being interested in people. For a long time, and I'm actually remiss in doing this because I've been so busy, I used to take off every day for an hour and go to the grocery. Not to buy anything, just to walk around and talk to housewives. I wanted to know about humanity. I wanted to know about their interests. I wanted about their lives. I wanted to see what they're buying. I wanted to know if products that had been advertised were really that good and why they were buying things. I wanted to know how they selected fruit. I wanted to know about their kids. I wanted to know all kinds of things. I go shopping to shopping centers once a week, not to buy anything, but just to be sold. And I'd ask questions, say, what's the biggest reason people buy this? What's the biggest item they want? What's the biggest question they ask? What's the best answer you give them? And I'd ask things like that. And I'd listen. I'm curious. I have an insatiable need for discovery. I love the concept of intellectual intercourse, of engaging in people's minds at deep, penetrating levels. Most people are afraid of that. Why would you be afraid to tap into experiences and knowledges that you don't have? Opportunities, insights, perspectives, understandings, awarenesses, lessons, safety admonishments that could protect you and your life and your family. I mean, I don't know. I think people, we tend to be so consumed with ourselves. And I think that that's very unfulfilling, Marty.
I hesitate to ask you this question, but I'm going to. It seems to me that a lot of people perceive change, motivation work, or training programs as emotionalism. And it seems to me that many of them are.
You mean like rah-rah, feel good?
Yeah. You're actually talking about changing thought at a substantive level.
Well, I'm not really talking about changing thought. I'm talking about getting yourself out of... my analogy is most of us... And in some ways, I'm still growing. So, I can be one of you because I got a long way to go in my pursuit. And every 5 years when I look back, I've grown so far. And I think I thought I was at a pinnacle there. I was at a way station. But most of us operate our lives, our careers, our businesses, our practices, and our relationships like a high-powered exotic sports car touring around town in first gear with the emergency brake on. We have the capacity, first of all, to let the brake off. We have the capacity to shift out of first into second, third, and hopefully into fourth or fifth, and even overdrive. We have the capacity to put a lot less taxation and fatigue on our faculty and intellectual capacity, but get far greater outcome and soar and zoom and resonate the power of our capacity to achieve in all aspects of our life. And all we have to do is take the governor off and learn how to shift into the performance, the higher performance modes that are naturally engineered into each and every one of our beings. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and so the key is breaking things down small enough so we'll be able to recognize that.
That is a key. I mean, lots of keys. The key is not being afraid of more, of higher, of better, of richer, of more productive, or whatever. It's embracing all the improvements that life and business and relationships hold for you in the most delightfully joyous and anticipatory way, and realizing that until you get your sea legs, you might not be perfect. Even though life has this great pleasure for you in your business, the first, it's like, what's your most favorite food?
I haven't thought about that in some time.
Well, what's your most favorite beverage?
I haven't thought about that.
Your most favorite hobby?
I'd say my favorite food is stir fry.
Okay. I will guarantee you, when you were about 5 years old, if your mother or father or whoever was preparing food, if you came from a wealthy family, your cook or your cook's cook made you stir fry, you probably spit it out.
Right.
Because you weren't ready to appreciate it.
Okay.
You had to discriminate and discern and learn to appreciate how good that was.
Right.
Most of us haven't been able to learn how to appreciate how good better really is, how much more we could accomplish, because in the process of learning, until you learn to love stir fry, you probably went from loathe to tolerating to moderately enjoying to enjoying to really enjoying to obsessing over it.
Okay, I'm with you.
Okay, so the point is, somewhere in your life you transcended spitting it out and started keeping it in, going, yum, yum, I want more, don't you think?
Yeah, now how do I do that with my life and optimizing my life?
Well, you realize that the first grasp at the brass ring is rarely successful. We live in a delusionary perception, Marty, that we're going to decide we want to be muscle-bound and virile or beautiful, and we're not exactly there yet, that in a matter of days we'll be there. Well, that's delusion. If you come with a false precept, you're going to get profound disappointment as your reward. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
But if you say, hey, in the scope of life, it's taken me, in my case, 47 years to get out of shape. If in 6 months I can be in shape, and all that means, and you break it down to a lousy 20 minutes every other day of reasonably exciting and energizing activity, that's not so bad, is it? If you contrast 6 months to 47 years, basically, I had to go 94 6 months to get where I am. If I only have to go 1 6 months to get out of where I am, that's pretty good.
Pretty sweet deal.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You re-denominate your reference frame.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. I have about maximum 8 minutes left. Let me ask you this one question.
Yes.
How can a person maximize the use of the Wizard's Edge tapes within the context of what we've been talking about today?
They do three things. They listen to a tape all the way through, not intermittently. Then they do something else. The moment they're done tying the line, they listen to it again. Because the second listen, they got to force themselves, because they're going to want to fast forward. They're going to want to not listen to something they've already heard. They're going to want to pass over something that they already passed over because they didn't think it was germane. They listen to every word twice in a row. Then they listen to it a third time, and they write down what each segment that is isolatable means to them and what action they could take and who they could call that has an already demonstrated success experience with whatever it is I'm talking about, and they call that person or multiple people, and they ask them the kind of questions I have suggested. If you'll just do that, and you'll do it for the next 6 months, I envy you, Marty. And I envy where your career or your bank account or your personal growth or your business achieved mental capacity will soar to. That's it?
That's it. Jay, it's been a delight talking to you.
Thank you.
Once again, we've been talking with Jay Abraham, the marketing genius on The Wizard's Edge. Hope you enjoyed today's program. Talk to you again. Bye-bye.